for everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sail, and today, with planes, trains and automobiles full of people heading off on holiday, we're taking a look at some travel books with a difference. Jasper Wynne takes us on an epic trip around Ireland in a kayak.
Through the summer, 19 small craft warning days in a row in July. That means force six or over every day for 19 days.
Historian John Key introduces Robert to some eccentric travellers.
Here's a man who's totally blind. He spent most of his life writing travel books.
Bill Bryson travels back in time to 1927.
And then when I looked into it, I discovered that actually they were only a small part of what happened in the summer of 1927. There were all these other things going on as well.
We hear from Ken Reed, who cycled around Britain raising funds for Talking Books. And I review a spoof travel guide to a former Soviet republic. That's all coming up in today's show. Jasper Wynne is a writer, photographer and broadcaster with a passion for adventure. He has canoed the length of the Danube, cycled across the Sahara, and traversed the Netherlands on roller skates. He's the author of Paddle, A Long Way Around Ireland, which charts his 1,000-mile circumnavigation of Ireland by sea kayak. It's a voyage of discovery that includes wild coastline, foul weather, encounters with basking sharks, and eccentric locals. Throughout it all, Jasper's resilience, comic ineptitude, and ability to fit in anywhere shine through. So, Jasper Wynne, welcome to Read On Air.
Great. Very good to be here. Really enjoying being here.
So, having read Paddle, I get the impression that you're the kind of man who cannot see a challenge and not want to do it.
You mean a river to kayak down, or a mountain to climb over, or a desert to cross? You're absolutely right. And then halfway across, I'll see something more interesting and get distracted and fail to get to the top of the mountain, or fail to get across the desert. And famously, I've just got distracted everywhere I've been. And kayaking around Ireland, which is 1,000 miles, if you miss most of Ireland out, you go point to point, point to point, was probably the first thing I've ever done which had a very simple mission statement: get back to where I started from.
It's a great book. I mean, you set out originally with your girlfriend at the time in fantastic weather, and within 4 days you're at death's door because of gallstones, and you have to give up the challenge for a year?
Yes, that was unexpected, and I feel really bad because I had told Elizabeth, we'll stop if it's going to be miserable, if we don't have fun, if we think it's unsafe. So we went off, the two of us, in two kayaks. Secretly, I thought, if she gives up, I'll keep going. The rich irony of being in intensive care 4 days later and in and out of hospital for the next year. So when I set off a year later, it was the first time I'd been in a kayak for a year. And I've got this, I'm a slow adventurer. And so my philosophy is not to prepare too much, to let comic ineptitude drive the travel. And above all, not to tire yourself out before something by training, because you'll get fit on the way, obviously.
Absolutely. Yes, you weren't quite prepared for what the weather gods threw at you, though, were you?
I wasn't really well prepared at all, to be honest. I knew just enough about sea kayaking to be safe. Safe in the sense of I had unlimited time, and that was what was important. People who feel pushed to do something in a certain time, whether it's mountains, deserts, sea, rivers, are up against real challenges. I had ample time, and it was well, because I thought it might take me 35, 40 days. It ended up taking 3.5 months to get round, mostly because the weather was really bad that year. There was a pattern of jet streams that had moved down, very changeable weather, so a lot of gales through the summer, 19 small craft warning days in a row in July. That means force six or over every day for 19 days.
And wind is your real problem. Wind, waves and swell when you're at sea. So my safety plan, very well worked out, was just to go to the pub until the weather got better. It meant that I spent, I really scared myself going around the south coast at the very beginning, long paddles from one headland to another. So the first big paddle was 14 miles across from Valentia Island to the end of the Dingle Peninsula. 14 miles at sea, you're 7 miles from land out in the middle. Except I was quite a lot further off land because I was being pushed out to sea towards America by the current and couldn't paddle fast enough to keep making real headway. And that's when I realised that I'd taken on a bit more of a challenge than I'd really anticipated. So I disappeared into Dick Mack's pub and became a musician for the next 3 weeks and laughed at people who went to sea.
So you clearly have moments of self-doubt, presumably, when you're out in the middle of the bay and the only solution is to carry on paddling. You were never tempted just to throw in the towel and stay at the pub and become musician in residence?
Well, I did do that for quite a long time. What happens, of course, is you rationalise things, the weather gets better, you talk to people, you assess your own ability. In that 3 weeks, apart from being a raconteur and guitar warrior in Dick Mack's and virtually every other pub in Dingle, I did do a lot more research. I talked to people. I learned much more about the currents and the weather patterns and how to use the tides. I did have this idea, this sort of obviously quite rare in me, work ethic, that if I just went out and dug water with a shovel for 8 hours a day, I would go a fixed amount of time. Now, I do know that there are tides and currents. I just hadn't taken on board how really important they are. Go out at the right time, if it's 5 o'clock in the morning, for example, and you have the tide and the current with you, you're just basically a piece of luggage on a carousel, just going round, eating lunch whilst you're drawn up the coast. Fight that, and you're just on a hiding to nothing. I became smarter. People taught me stuff. I talked to people who knew. I talked to fishermen. I talked to local people in pubs. Great place to learn everything.
And it's something that comes through very strongly from the earliest pages of the book. I mean, since being a child, you have learned skills on the job. You strike me, for all the fact that you talk about your comic ineptitude, you are a fast learner, somebody who pays attention when shown how to do something by an expert, and you really seem to relish learning, but on the job rather than in the schoolroom.
Well, that's just been my background. I've been, I think, very lucky. I left school when I was 10, just complete agreement between the whole schooling system of Western Europe and I that we were incompatible. But I was very lucky. That sounds like a recipe for disaster, and objectively might have been. But I was brought up in Southwest Ireland, and a very privileged background because we had books, we had horses. My father was an inventor. He was a very open-minded, can-do kind of guy. He employed people, but he employed them as engineers on the basis of what they made. He wasn't obsessed by formal schooling. Brilliant if you're trying to leave school at 10 to have a father who's hostage to fortune. But I didn't just leave school and watch television because we didn't have television. I began learning from people around me, everything from horses I'd been brought up with, but how to sail boats, how to fish, how to log wood, how to write. I had friends who were writers when I was young, and they made writing sound like a doable kind of thing. And that was just, for me, a passport to what I've done ever since, which is I always wanted to be a writer because if you can immerse yourself in something very deeply, very intensely, very quickly, but you don't have to do it for the rest of your life. You run away with the circus. I spent 2 weeks working with a circus. That probably, for most people, is as long as you want to work with a circus. But you do want to do it for 2 weeks in your life, surely.
Absolutely. But I suppose with writing and with what you term your human power trips, your self-propelled trips across Europe, round Ireland, it's as much about discovering yourself as discovering the landscape that you're putting yourself in.
I think it's the the union of the two, actually. Kayaking around Ireland, it's not that I'm a keen sea kayaker. I enjoyed it immensely, but you wouldn't really want to spend 3.5 months with a wet arse going around scared a lot of the time if the rewards weren't so immense. One of the great things was that the coast of West Island, the coast of Europe, I think we're beginning to discover, as more and more people are windsurfing and sailboarding and sailing and sea kayaking particularly, how much wildlife there is out there. It's like a huge, great safari park of whales, sunfish, basking sharks, blue shark. And to be part of that, to be in somebody, into another species world, and to find they're at home there, dolphins and the turtles out there, seals. That's the reward. It suddenly means you're part of a wider world, and the paddling is just the way to get there.
I get the sense that being neither fish nor fowl, but being adequate on the water or on land, gives you that sense of humility and a connection with the world about you.
Oh, Red, you put it so well. Neither fish nor fowl. When you're a kayaker, you are on the surface between these two different mediums, between the water, which is just, I find it awesome in the genuine sense of how much is below one. One looks down and on a clear day, you might be able to sense 20 foot down into the waters. But they can go hundreds, thousands of feet below you. There's all that stuff happening. And then the birds, I'm a sort of keen, interested bird watcher, bird warrior, not a proper ornithologist, not a twitcher. I just love birds and what they do. I had a particular relationship with Fulmers because they're a bit of an interloper. They've only moved down these parts quite recently in the last century. And so they're a bit sort of, they've got a bit of humility as well. They don't flock together like gannets and gulls. They tend to come by in pairs. And Fulmers are just such beautiful birds, and they always come in. They're a bit sort of like cats. They just come in and just say hello. And I promise you, every time I pass a Fulmer, I might be 3 or 4 miles offshore, they just dip a wing and they come over and they just kind of do a little kind of flyby. Don't hang around, and off they go again. I got very superstitious about saying hello to Fulmers, a bit like magpies on land. And I loved being in that precarious place, as you call it, between fish and fowl. And that's what a kayak, human-powered, very simple. I mean, a kayak is really nothing more than a sort of a coffin you sit up in. Takes you out into that world. And animals, seals, dolphins, basking sharks, seem to either ignore it or accept it as some strange form of badly designed turtle.
Now, there is you mentioned sharks, and there is an incident where you are being followed by a fin, much to the upset of people who were watching you from the coast. Were you scared, or did you know that it was a basking shark that was following you?
I had quite a number of incidents. Basking sharks are huge. I mean, I think 3 tons. All those wonderful statistics, like they can filter an Olympic swimming pool of water in an hour of swimming, and so forth. They are massive, but they, of course, they're plankton feeders. But it was a year when there was a lot of sightings of great white shark off the coast of Britain and of Ireland. Some of them were hoaxes, some of them fakes, but it was a bit of a kind of a story going around that year. You've got to ask yourself, if you wanted to get a picture of a great white shark and sell it for thousands to the media during shark things, what are the chances of doing it in a small kayak in thousands and thousands of square miles of ocean? Possibly quite high, because I was off the Mayo coast in very difficult weather. It was weather I had to, you don't really concentrate, you just have to be fully aware. And I looked around and there was a fin, as you say, following me. And I thought, it's a dolphin. Now, we have a lovely relationship with dolphins. Dolphins are always in mythology, rescuing people and coming along and dancing around. There was Flipper when I was a kid. I looked around and I saw the fin. I was like, it's a dolphin, quite a large dolphin. Then I suddenly saw, heart-stoppingly, there was also a second fin, a tail fin, upright behind. Now, dolphins, and you know, have flattened flukes with their mammals. Sharks have an upright tail fin. And I was being followed by a large shark. And I thought, basking shark. And I realised it was so close, I could see that it wasn't. It had a rounded nose. And I still don't know what it was. The most likely thing was it was a poor beagle shark. it was not much smaller than the length of the boat, which is sort of around about, the boat's 16 foot long. It was absolutely wonderful. I thought, if I can get a picture of this following me during shark hysteria, this whole trip is paid for. I am a coward. I did not take my hands off the paddle, twist round and take a picture of that shark. I thought, I'm just going to stay upright in this situation. But what it did, it was like being followed by a lion in the veld, but realizing you're not in real danger unless you do something really silly. And I tried not to do anything really silly. What it did tell me was how much big stuff is out there. It is like the Serengeti for marine life off the coast of Europe. It's not just Ireland. Ireland's good for it, but it's all over the place. And that was what I really took back from the trip at the end, was how much wilderness there is out at sea, real wilderness.
Thanks again, Jasper. Paddle is out now in print and ebook versions, with an audiobook on the way. And still to come on today's show, we've got Bill Bryson and a spoof travel guide.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support, so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
John Key is a prolific and highly respected historian who has documented Britain's colonial past and made it accessible to all. With another of his books entering the RNIB library, he joined Robert Kirkwood in the studio to discuss some of the interesting stories he's turned up on the way.
Now, China is a massive country. Was it quite an undertaking to put an entire history in one volume?
Yes, I mean, it's an incredibly long history. China has probably one of the longest histories in the world. It's certainly 5,000 years, and to write a 5,000-year history in one volume is a bit of a challenge. But I was fortunate in that I'd done something very similar, a similar history of India about 10 years previously. And so I sort of knew the problems of writing a comprehensive history of a long, long period in one volume, and I sort of had ideas about how to approach it. So it wasn't quite as intimidating as it might have been.
And history is very important to the Chinese people, and adventure much more important than to us in the West.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, China is one of the few countries in the world that really defines itself not by its kind of geography, its terrain, or even by its people, but particularly by its history, by its past. And every dynasty and every regime that China has ever had has always looked back to the past to justify, to legitimize itself. And so history is incredibly important, and the Chinese probably have the longest tradition of history writing of any people in the world. So there's an immense amount of it. Again, contrasting it with India, you know, there's really hardly a date in Indian history before about 1000 AD, which is certain, and there are practically no written histories prior to that sort of period, the Islamic period. In China, it's completely the opposite. There are written histories from way back, from 200 or 300 years BC, and they look back to an even longer tradition. So there's absolutely masses of documentation.
Even today, with the People's Republic, they seem to politically have a very long-term view, which is rather opposed to our 4-year or year government.
Yes, well, I think if you've got this long tradition of history behind you, you do tend to work in longer sort of time segments than we do, less short-termism. But particularly in terms of economics, I mean, it's not just that China has a vast history, but it is such a vast country that, you know, it's like turning it around is like turning around a large passenger liner or something. It takes a long time, and so they do tend to take a longer view of things and are prepared to put up with more in the short term than we would. Also, of course, not being subject to frequent elections like we are, the governments and regimes are not so accountable to the mass of the people,
which isn't always a good thing though.
No, of course not.
Now, you have been on the show before, at least one of your books has, with eccentric travellers. Now, forgive me, this may, you may have written this a long time ago, but do you remember much about the traveller James Holman?
Yes, indeed. He was a blind traveller, a very unusual story, really. I mean, here's a man who's totally blind, who spent most of his life writing travel books, and he travelled all over the world. I can't remember the dates offhand. I think it was late 19th century, and he was famous as a blind traveller, and you would think that travel writing wasn't really the obvious choice for a person who couldn't see where he was going and needed a lot of assistance and so on. But actually, Holman was a brilliant travel writer. He managed to capture the essence of places and people and so on much more successfully than a lot of sighted travellers. And he was a great celebrity in his day, and he went all over the place. I mean, he went all over Russia, all over Africa, an incredible man. But as you say, it's sometimes as I've written about it.
Yeah, Eccentric Travellers has been on the show before, and it's just a wonderful read. The naturalist who wrestled boa constrictors, and the evangelist who went through the Hindu Kush naked. It's a fantastic book, and Eccentric Travellers is available from RNIB Talking Books. Now, one of your books that really interested me, how was Everest named?
Mount Everest was named after a man who actually pronounced his name Everest.
Right.
He's called George Everest. He was a colonel in the British Indian Army, but he was also, much more importantly, a scientist, and he completed a measurement of the Indian subcontinent. If you can imagine measuring the Indian subcontinent, it's actually quite tricky. In the 19th century, it involved actually covering all the grounds and using a system called triangulation, or trigonometry in simple terms. And they measured what they called an arc of the meridian, i.e. a line of longitude from the extreme south of India, the very tip near Sri Lanka, right up to the Himalayas. This was an amazing undertaking. It took about 40 years, and Everest happened to be the man who completed this great arc of the meridian from roughly central India up through Delhi and so on up to the Himalayas at a place called Dehradun, and there he made his final measurements and astronomical observations to complete this, what was then the most ambitious measurement of the Earth's curvature, of the Earth's surface, that had ever been undertaken. And it was as a result of this measurement that for the first time it became possible to actually work out how high the peaks of the Himalayas were, because they had a firm base in terms of its location in the grid of the Earth, and also in terms of its altitude from which to measure the highest peaks. And it was in his honour that the highest of them all was called after him, and we call it Mount Everest. He would probably have preferred Mount Everest.
China, A History, and Eccentric Travellers are available as RNIB Talking Books, and all of John Key's books are available wherever books are sold. John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert and John Key. Eccentric Travellers is TB4415. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come, a guide to somewhere you'll never visit and the books of Ken Reed's life. But first, no discussion of travel writing would be complete without that wonderful wizard of wayfaring, Bill Bryson. So it's back to Robert.
It is impossible to imagine what it must have been like to be Charles Lindbergh in that summer. From the moment he left his room in the morning, He was touched and jostled and bothered. Every person on earth who could get near enough wanted to grasp his hand or clap him on the back. He had no private life anymore. Shirts he sent to the laundry never came back. Chicken bones and napkins from his dinner plate were fought over in kitchens. He could not go for a walk or pop into a bank or drugstore. If he went into a men's room, people followed. Checks he wrote were rarely cashed. Recipients preferred to frame them instead. No part of his life was normal, and there was no prospect that it ever would be again. As Lindbergh was discovering, it was a lot more fun to get famous than to be famous.
That was Bill Bryson reading from his book One Summer, America, 1927. And I'm delighted to say he joins me now in the Talking Book Studios.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you're in the RNIB Talking Book Studios reading your book One Summer.
Yes, and the summer is about the summer of 1927 in America, when all of this amazing stuff happened, mostly to do with popular culture. But it was the summer in which Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. It was the summer in which Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs, which if you're a baseball fan is a huge thing. It was the summer in which the anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti were executed, which was a very big story at the time. It was the summer in which they invented television and in which radio came of age by the starting of network radio broadcasts in America. And lots of other things. It was the summer of the Great Mississippi Flood, the worst natural disaster in modern American history. It was the summer they filmed The Jazz Singer, the first talking picture, which obviously completely transformed popular entertainment. And just lots and lots of other things, all happening in this one summer. Almost all of it happened in the United States, and the rest of the world was strangely quiet that year. Everything happened in America.
Now, was it coincidence that you discovered all these events happening at the same time?
Pretty much. I mean, the starting point was that I had always been fascinated from childhood somehow by the idea that Charles Lindbergh and Babe Ruth had done these two things, these two iconic American events, at the same time. And I'd had it in mind for a long time that it might be an interesting approach to try to write a dual biography of these two iconic American figures, but with the narrative trajectory sort of heading for intersection at this one summer when the two moments came together. And then when I looked into it, I discovered that actually they were only a small part of what happened in the summer of 1927. There were all these other things going on as well. It was the summer they started building Mount Rushmore, for instance. It was just one thing after another. And the more I looked into it, the more I discovered that it was... What's amazing about the summer was all the stuff that happened and how it all kind of interconnected in ways that have never really been noticed before, because nobody's ever really written about them as a mass of events. People have written biographies of Lindbergh or biographies of Babe Ruth or that kind of thing, but haven't looked at them all as a great mass of events.
Is it very much like At Home, which was sort of your home was a starting point for a collection of different histories? Is One Summer sort of the same idea?
Yeah, in a sense that it's bringing together a lot of disparate things that aren't usually brought together. But here, I mean, At Home, I was really much more indulgent because I could go almost any direction I wanted to with it. I mean, because almost everything, you know, is pertinent to the history of domesticity in one way or another. This one, I was locked in. I was fixed on having to write about those things that were actually immediately pertinent to the summer of 1927. So this was much more much more confined, which in a lot of ways was great for me, because I didn't have to go looking all over the place. I could keep focused on one particular summer. For a man who changed the world, Henry Ford traveled in very small circles. He resided his whole life within a dozen miles of his birthplace, a farm at Dearborn, just outside Detroit. He saw little of the wider world and cared even less for it. He was defiantly narrow-minded, barely educated, and at least close to functionally illiterate. His beliefs were powerful but consistently dubious, and made him seem, in the words of the New Yorker, mildly unbalanced. He did not like bankers, doctors, liquor, tobacco, idleness of any sort, pasteurized milk, Wall Street, overweight people, war, books or reading, J.P. Morgan and Company, capital punishment, tall buildings, college graduates, Roman Catholics, or Jews. Especially, he didn't like Jews. Once he hired a Hebraic scholar to translate the Talmud in a manner designed to make Jewish people appear shifty and avaricious. His ignorance was a frequent source of wonder. He believed that the earth could not support the weight placed on it by skyscrapers, and that eventually cities would collapse in on themselves, as in some kind of biblical apocalypse. Engineers explained to him that a large skyscraper typically weighed about 60,000 tons, while the rock and earth excavated for the foundations would weigh more like 100,000 tons, so that skyscrapers actually reduced the burden on the earth beneath them. But Ford was unpersuaded. He seldom let facts or logic challenge the certainty of his instincts.
You're in the Talking Books studios in Camden reading One Summer, but in the past I've heard your books read by people like Bill Roberts or Kerry Shale or a multitude of different narrators. But a few years back you started doing them yourself. Was there a reason for that?
Well, two reasons really. One was that in America, the audio publishers in America started strongly encouraging me to read my own books. I guess there's more of an impulse over there to get the authors to read their own books if they're willing to do so.
Mm.
And partly it was also that some of my books had been read in America by Americans who were very good readers but weren't necessarily familiar with the subjects I was writing about. And I mean, one of the things I remember was cringing when I read or listened to audio recordings of, like, Notes from a Small Island, my book about Britain. Because the reader, although a very gifted reader, I mean, he was good at animation and all of that, he made a lot of very basic mistakes in pronunciation.
Mm.
I don't remember specifics, but things like saying Edinburgh or Glasgow and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which made me look a little bit, out of touch, particularly as I'm supposed to be writing with some authority about the British Isles.
Mm-mm.
The one thing that you can guarantee is that if there is then a mistake in pronunciation, I've got nobody to blame but myself.
I wandered through the city, examining hotels from the street, but they all seemed a bit grand for me, and eventually ended up at the Central Tourist Office, feeling mildly lost and far from home. I wasn't quite sure what I was doing here. I looked through racks of leaflets for shire horse centers, petting zoos, falconry centers, miniature pony centers, model railways, butterfly farms, and something called, I regret to say, Twiggy Winky's Farm and Hedgehog Hospital, none of which seemed to address my leisure requirements.
That was a clip from an American version of Notes from a Small Island. Now, you were initially famous for travel books, and as with many interviews, I've asked listeners to tweet or email in questions for you, and one lovely one was, did your walk in the woods put you off travel?
It took me off. It put me off going for long-distance hikes in the American wilderness. That's for damn sure. But no, it didn't put me off travel at all. I still love travel. Part of the problem I have is that I haven't entirely run out of places to write about, but I have, because of the kinds of books I write, I have a much more limited range of places I can comfortably write about. I couldn't go to a third world country and write the kinds of books I write about because my books are based on the idea that I can actually kind of take the mickey out of the countries I'm writing about. And if you're doing that, in Canada or France or Britain or, a big, powerful, rich first world nation, that's one thing. But to go and do those kinds of jokes at the expense of people in, India or parts of Africa or, the third world, it could seem quite cruel. And I certainly don't want to do that. It could also be, even if I'm not being cruel, it could just kind of come across as in bad taste or as not very good. So, you know, there's whole areas of the world that my kind of humor wouldn't work and I wouldn't want to go to write about in the kinds of books people expect me to write. But that isn't to say I wouldn't want to go there and have the experiences myself just for the pleasure of it.
Did you find writing your African diary quite hard then?
I did indeed, and that was sort of a test to see, you know, to test this proposition. And if you look at African Diary, I mean, it's you can see it's struggling to be funny because it's, you know, I'm very limited in what I can write about. We were visiting, you know, one of the world's most horrible slums in Nairobi, and there was just no jokes there. I mean, this isn't something you can make jokes about. You know, there's just absolutely no scope for jokes at all. So the jokes that are in African Diary are really all inward directed at me and the people, the British people I was traveling with. And it was, you know, it was really quite limiting. It would have been hard to do a full-blown book that way. So, I mean, I realized when I was doing it, I kind of suspected before I did it that would be a challenge, and so it proved.
Now, you mentioned there one country that you haven't written about, Canada.
Canada. I love Canada. Canada's a country I would be very happy to make fun of or, you know, to make jokes about. And I think, you know, they would be, I'm sure, very happy to have me do so because, you know, they could take it. It's obviously a big, grown-up, robust nation. And, you know, I wouldn't be patronizing them or really insulting them. I'd just be kind of teasing them. So I would love to do Canada. The problem is that most of the world has a kind of natural bias against Canada, in that it is just famous for being dull, and people are not automatically interested in it at all.
Now, there's a clip coming up I chose specifically to go with this next question, which came in on Twitter. Do dogs hate you that much?
They do, absolutely. Every single one of them. But no, there's one exception. Now, my daughter recently got a little Cocker Spaniel, a puppy, and he seems to love me, and I'm happy to love him in return, but that doesn't in any way nullify all the other dogs hating me in the world.
I guess it would take about 20 minutes to cut through the park, or the reserve, as Australians call these things, but I was probably about halfway along when, from an indeterminate distance off to the right, there came the bark of a dog, tentative and experimental, as if to say, "Who's that?" It wasn't very close or intimidating, but it was clearly the bark of a big dog. Something in its timbre said, "Meat eater, black, very big, not too many generations removed from wolf." Almost in the same instant it was joined by the bark of a companion dog, also big, and this bark was decidedly less experimental. This bark said, "Red alert, trespasser on our territory." Within a minute, they'd worked themselves up into a considerable frenzy. Nervously, I quickened my pace. Dogs don't like me. It is a simple law of the universe, like gravity. I am not exaggerating when I say that I have never passed a dog that didn't act as if it thought I was about to take its Alpo. Dogs that have not moved from the sofa in years will, at the sniff of me passing outside, rise in gorge and hurl themselves at shut windows. I have seen tiny dogs, no bigger than Fluffy Slipper, jerk little old ladies off their feet and drag them over open ground in a quest to get at my blood and sinew. Every dog on the face of the earth wants me dead. And now here I was, alone in an empty woods, which suddenly seemed very large and lonely, and two big and angry-sounding dogs had me in their sights.
Thanks to Robert and Bill Bryson. As Robert said, a wide selection of Bill's books is available from the library. For more details, simply go to rniblibrary.com or call the Action Line on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
RNIB, supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB News Agent Service, which delivers the latest news, magazines and stories in a range of accessible formats to people with sight loss, is now free for under 16s. Reading can make the world of difference, and it's vital that all blind and partially sighted children can access the same content as their sighted peers in a fun and creative way. Current titles in the RNIB News Agent Service include BBC Horrible Histories, First News, Aquila, National Geographic, and RNIB Blast Off. Formats include audio CD or USB, email or Braille. To register for RNIB Newsagent, please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email us at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, and today we're looking at travel stories with a difference. On the way, we'll be talking to the blind former chair of RNIB Scotland, who cycled round Britain to raise money for RNIB Talking Books. But first, when we were discussing ideas for a show about alternative travel, Robert's eyes lit up and he asked whether I knew Mulvania. It sounded familiar. Was it in Eastern Europe? Former Soviet Republic, which had emerged after the collapse of the Berlin Wall with a new name and hopes of joining the EU? But in the end, I had to confess my ignorance. Well, said Robert, there's your next Educating Read. And it's even read by one of your favourite narrators.
Today, Mulvania is a country caught between the old world and the new, and the contrasts are many. It has provisional NATO membership and healthy IMF ratings, but is yet to declare witch-burning an indictable offence. Public services such as healthcare and education are woefully under-resourced, yet there are 9 government-funded TV networks. Despite these contradictions, or perhaps because of them, more and more people are visiting each year to experience the unique charm that is Mulvania.
Mulvania, a land untroubled by modern dentistry, is a spoof travel guidebook. First published in Australia in 2003, it became an international hit, much to the surprise of many, including its trio of Aussie authors. It claims to be the jet lag travel guide to the Eastern European Republic of Mulvania, birthplace of the Polka, Whooping Cough, and home to Europe's oldest nuclear reactor. Bordered by Germany, Hungary, Slovakia, Slovenia, and Romania, Mulvania, we are told, has too long been overlooked as a tourist destination. But it has much to offer. The book goes on to explore the history, geography, culture, places to see and things to do in this fictitious republic. Its landscape, we are told, consists of bald mountains giving way to bare plains. Its architecture is mostly in the Soviet-era brutalist concrete style. Apparently, UNESCO is keen to designate Mulvania as a World Heritage Site in recognition of its being a prime example of a site of significant monotony. The locals, the guide explains, are friendly without being welcoming and enjoy a diet of pigs, cabbage and beets.
Mulvanians love eating out, preferably in France or Germany. But those dining within the borders of this unique country will find it a vibrant and exciting culinary experience. Only in Mulvania can one sample traditional fare such as horse flab, the local pickled meat delicacy, washed down with a glass of Zeerstum, a liqueur one reader described as tasting like a mixture of vodka and avgas. Quite understandable, as both are common ingredients. Most Mulvanians also have a sweet tooth, often the only one left after a lifetime of overly sweetened food. And national desserts here are a gastronome's delight, with a surprisingly wide variety given that so many of them are based on the parsnip. American-style coffee shops are common throughout the country. But of course, old habits die hard, and most mornings around 11 a.m, you'll see many elderly Mulvanians propped up in a Zvadovar bar, drinking cups of this heavily sugared chicory extract through cork filters.
Traveller's tip. Zvadovar cafes are a great way to soak in the atmosphere. But remember that sitting at a table outside can be costly. A better idea is to join the locals standing up inside the cafe. Although, be warned, you will be charged extra if your elbows come into contact with any part of the bar surface area.
Historically, Mulvania has been at the crossroads of Europe, plundered and trampled by armies en route to invade or retreat from somewhere else. Mulvania's first king, Fyodor, set about unifying the country by killing off as many of its inhabitants as possible, a policy continued by subsequent rulers, most recently Soviet Russia and the current regime of Mulvanian nationalists. It's all a bit too true for comfort at times. But though it pokes fun at the worst excesses of former Eastern Bloc republics, the book's light-hearted tone and silly gags keep it from spilling over into biting satire. Some critics worry about cultural stereotyping, and, like all parodies, it does draw caricatures. But I found it more in the vein of Allo Allo than Borat. Besides, what's really being ridiculed here is the travel book industry, those smug insider's guides to undiscovered places that cram the bookshelves. Some of the funniest passages of Mulvania are the biographies of its fictitious compilers. They're a mixed bag of misfits and eternal backpackers who marvel at things abroad that they would find unacceptable at home.
The authors. Rick Van Duggan. Born in Missouri, Rick always dreamed of travelling the world and, at the age of 18, begged his folks to let him spend a year overseas. So enthusiastic about the concept were his parents that they agreed to send him for three. Since that time, Rick has been wandering the planet, earning his living as a travel writer and freelance photographer. He's worked on numerous guidebooks, including Baltic Europe, Czech Mate, and Kazakhstan on $1 a month. Philippe Miseret. A professional traveller since his youth, there is not a city or town Philippe has not recently been disappointed by. No matter how obscure the destination, you can bet he has been there before you and found it not half as good as it was in the 1970s. His earlier works include Turkey Before It Was Spoilt, India the Hard Way, Southeast Asia on Less Than You Need, and Unnecessarily Tough Travel. Philippe helped compile our complaints section.
All in all, then, Mulvania is not a book to be taken seriously, or to be read in one sitting. It's best kept as a funny antidote to whichever travel guide you're taking on holiday with you. The talking book version that I downloaded from Overdrive was TB13831. It was read in a suitably tongue-in-cheek fashion by David Thorpe and Charlotte Strevens. So, hats off to Robert for another excellent educating read suggestion. Do you have a book that you think would expand my horizons, or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share with us? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's time for Books of Your Life. And this week, Robert Kirkwood talked to Ken Reed. Ken has retinitis pigmentosa and is a former chair of RNIB Scotland. In 2016, 30 years after he started losing his sight, he decided to raise money for RNIB by cycling from Edinburgh to London via Belfast, Cardiff and Dublin. The journey was called Cycle 750, even though he ended up cycling over 800 miles. He raised £13,000 for the Talking Book Service, sponsoring six new books. We'll find out what two of those books are in a moment. But first, Robert asked Ken when he discovered his joy of reading.
I was quite a late developer in reading. I was not much of a reader when I was at school. I struggled an awful lot with books. But as a late teenager, early 20s, I suddenly discovered that reading books was just such an important thing to be able to do. And it was a great pleasure, a great relaxation. And I started picking up books and started reading quite avidly and had all sorts of things on the go. And really got quite hooked into to book reading from that time onwards. And it became a vital part of my life.
So what was the first book that you remember that sparked that joy of reading?
Probably I would take as my earliest book would be Lord of the Rings. I did actually try it when I was at school. I had to read something, and I started Lord of the Rings, and I got so far through it, and I was struggling to get on through it, and I had to stop and get on with something else in order that I could finish the school assignment. I picked it up again as a student and started reading it and finished it and loved it, and I've read it several times since then. I now own my own copy in Daisy and keep it on the shelf and revisit it. And actually last year when I was doing my own journey, cycling from Edinburgh to London on a bike, when I was staying in hotels overnight, I had Lord of the Rings on my book player and read of another journey while I was in the midst of my own journey.
Frodo was in the water close to the edge, and a great tree root seemed to be over him and holding him down. But he was not struggling. Sam gripped him by the jacket and dragged him from under the root, and then with difficulty hauled him onto the bank. Almost at once he woke and coughed and spluttered. "Do you know, Sam," he said at length, "the beastly tree threw me in. I felt it. The big root just twisted round and tipped me in." "Oh, you were dreaming, I expect, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "You shouldn't sit in such a place if you feel sleepy."
And so what about a book that you would return to again and again?
Probably my favourite book of all time is Crow Road by Ian Banks. I read that, 20-odd years ago. And I have read that a couple of times since then. I just find it, it's the mixture between humour and tragedy and the whole Scottish placing of it. Even though I'm from the East Coast and don't quite know where Crow Road is, just the whole story just was, it just really, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I thought the talking book version was brilliant, beautifully read. It captured everything and, loved it to bits and would still put it right there at the very top of my favourite books.
When he was younger than I am now, my Uncle Rory went on what was supposed to be a world trip. He got as far as India, fell in love with the place, went walkabout, circulating, to Kashmir from Delhi, then along the hem of the Himalayas, crossing the Ganga at Patna, asleep on the train, then zigzagging country to coast and back again, but always heading or trying to head south, collecting names and steam trains and friends and horrors and adventures. Then at the very hanging tip of the subcontinent, from the last stone at low tide on Cape Cormoran, one slack dog day, reversing, heading north and west, still swinging from interior to coast, writing it all down in a series of school exercise books, rejoicing in the wild civility of that ocean of people, the vast ruins and fierce geography of the place, its accrescent layers of antiquity and bureaucracy, the bizarre images and boggling scale of it.
And what about a book you've read recently?
One of the most recent books I've read was Sunset Song by Lewis Grassic Gibbon. I should have read that back when I was at school. It's Scotland's favourite book, according to the BBC, and I never read it. I did try and read it after I'd lost my sight, and I got the audiobook version that was available in the RNIB Talking Book Library, and it was a pretty poor quality, old-fashioned style recording. And so I was kind of disappointed with it, and I just couldn't stick it. So I gave it up at that time. I was very fortunate that there was an opportunity to sponsor the recording of a new version as a consequence of the Cycle 750 proceeds. And so I've just finished reading the new version of Sunset Song. And it is so much better, such a good reading. It's read by Eileen McCallum, who's quite a well-known Scottish actress. She does a wonderful job with the Aberdeenshire language that many people might struggle to understand, but she just reads it beautifully. And I found it really a very, very enjoyable read. And I was really chuffed. I was asked before I set off on that bike ride, if I could choose what book to record, what would I go for? And I said, well, actually, we don't get to choose when you've done a fundraiser. You guess just get to choose off a list of available books. So, and they said, no, but if you could really choose. So I told them about the poor quality version and said that would be what I would choose. So that it was actually there to have. I thought, fantastic. This is just so good.
Below and around where Chris Guthrie lay, the June moors whispered and rustled and shook their cloaks, yellow with broom and powdered faintly with purple. That was the heather, but not the full passion of its colour yet. And in the east, against the cobalt blue of the sky, lay the shimmer of the North Sea. That was by Bervey, and maybe the wind would veer there in an hour or so, and you'd feel the change in the life and strum of the thing, bringing a streaming coolness out of the sea. But for days now the wind had been in the south. It shook and played in the moors and went dandering up the sleeping grampians. The rushes pecked and quivered about the loch when its hand was upon them, but it brought more heat than cold, and all the parks were fair parched, sucked dry, the red clay soil of Blawiri's gaping open for the rain that seemed never coming.
But it wasn't the only book that was sponsored by the bike ride, and I was also really pleased to be able to sponsor a book about an outdoor adventurer who also is affected by sight loss. And indeed, I was very privileged to meet the author of that book. So Cycle 750 also sponsored The Blind Man of Hoy by Red Sail, and I've thoroughly enjoyed reading that book as well.
Nothing can prepare you for coming face to face with the Old Man of Hoy. For months, I'd glibly told people that I was going to climb this sea stack roughly the shape and size of the gherkin. From the top of the promontory, it was once the tip of, the old man hadn't appeared too intimidating. But with each precarious step down the shattered cliff, it had loomed larger. So by the time I was standing on the rockfall causeway that used to form its mighty arch, the giant's stated height looked to be an underestimate. As a teenager, in the mid-1980s, I'd watched Chris Bonington and Joe Brown scale this perpendicular monolith in a documentary about the Big Climb, the BBC's epic live coverage of their 1967 ascent, and thought, I want to do that. Within a year, I'd found a way to go rock climbing through school and got hooked. Age 19, I discovered I was going blind. It was like taking a long fall and wondering whether the person belaying was ever going to stop the rope. After a brief battle, I'd hung up my harness for the best part of 20 years and tried to ignore the cravings.
Well, that was a surprise. All of Ken's suggestions are available from the RNIB library, including Sunset Song, which you'll find as part of a trilogy under the title A Scots Quare. And if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks again to all my guests and everybody who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you're enjoying, and suggestions for books that I might like to read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, you can find all our past shows, complete with exclusive interviews, on our Audioboom page. Simply head to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.